Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta. Do you ever get the feeling that the world in which we live is becoming more fantastical and more surreal? Does it seem like the United States is kind of a fantasy land?
This large majority of people believe that demons and angels are at work here.
Sounds like a lot of supernatural baloney to me.
Supernatural. Perhaps. Baloney. Perhaps not.
Kurt Anderson is the best-selling novelist and host of the public radio show, Studio 360. He'll join us. Plus, one of today's most exciting fiction writers, Otessa Moshfegh, tells us why she's homesick for another world. Also, we'll listen to some music recorded on X-rays and explore the renaissance of black horror films. And why do the weirdest news stories come from Florida? That's all coming up on Beta in just a moment. First this.
Previously on Beta.
Song was pretty white.
I never had anybody say that.
Tragedy of your times, my young friends, is that you may get exactly what you want.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Beta is a polyphonic mosh pit where high culture and low culture collide. We take an immersive, innovative, playful, and provocative approach to exploring arts, culture, and technology. And it contains no infobesity, none whatsoever. Today, we'll find out why Florida is America's leading producer of weird news. And we'll meet literary sensation Otessa Moshfegh. Have you ever listened to music on X-ray films? We'll do that, so you can check that off your bucket list. You're welcome. We'll also talk about the renaissance of black horror movies in the wake of the success of Get Out. But first, welcome to Fantasyland! Whether you know it or not, you're living in Fantasyland. We all are.
You're soaking in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Americans have been soaking in it for the past five centuries. That's what Kurt Anderson says. He's a best-selling novelist and the host of the public radio show Studio 360. Kurt's also the author of a new book called Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire. And he's come up with a great phrase to describe Fantasyland's incredible sprawl that permeates all of our lives. He calls it the fantasy industrial complex.
Well, by that, I am mainly referring to the organized businesses and institutions and enterprises, nonprofit and otherwise, and profit-making, that are engaged in this, whether it's all of the Hollywood enterprises of movies and video games and television and all the rest, all the obvious stuff that has been part of our sort of show business past and where we've immersed ourselves more and more, but also the sort of amateur versions of that, from cosplay to LARPs to all the rest, where people are immersing in their own various kinds of fantasies. But I also extend that to much of the internet, to much of the real estate business, to much of the restaurant industry, to much of religion, to much of politics these days. So what the point of that phrase was to say that it's not just show business and it's not just entertainment, that there are connections between all these other enterprises that we don't think of as engaged in the business of fantasy, that are, to various degrees and more, engaged in the business of fantasy.
So how far back does the fantasy industrial complex go?
Yeah, I'd say it began in the early, mid-1800s and really had scaled up to its modern proportions early in the 20th century.
So is it fair to say that this kind of magical thinking is baked into the very idea of American exceptionalism?
That's what I came to believe. I'm not sure I started believing that, but my history and my inquiry and my tracing its roots back has led me to believe that it's baked pretty deeply into it in various forms, whether it's the religious forms that our earliest English settlers in New England had of this extreme sect of, frankly, of Christian zealots, or the people in the South at that time who came desperately believing that they would, in this Eden that was the New World, where none of them had ever been, would find gold everywhere and would get rich overnight. They didn't. And so those just desperately wishful cases of magical thinking were our beginnings.
Yeah. And this raises the question, is the United States the only country that has a fantasy industrial complex, or do other countries have comparable complexes?
Compared to the developed world, we are different. Now, it's not like, oh, we only do this in America and they don't do it at all. Of course, there are people who are magical thinkers and delusional believers in all kinds of things everywhere. But we are more. The survey data on various beliefs makes it pretty clear to me that we are more inclined this way, more predisposed this way than people in those other countries. But especially when it comes to extreme religiosity, it's amazing to me. Graph us against the rest of the world. We are always among the lesser developed countries in terms of the nature and passion with which we believe in various kinds of supernatural religious things, and very unlike the rest of the rich world.
As we start to pray, we're asking you, our friend watching through television, to join us as these are joining us here in the Big Tent Cathedral. We want your
compassion. So we're not absolutely unique, of course. It seems clear to me, and I make the case in the argument, that we are peculiar. That is part of our exceptionalism.
Yeah. Another important factor in the growth of the fantasy industrial complex is digital technology, the internet. How has the internet contributed to the rise of magical thinking?
Before the internet, before the web specifically, before it was this mass medium, people who passionately believed untrue things existed, Lord knows, and sometimes found fellow believers and fellow travelers and created groups and so forth. But it was much harder to maintain one's belief in these alternative realities or these untrue conspiracy theories or whatever they were. The web gave people several things. They gave people who believe, say, in chemtrails as a way that the government is poisoning Americans.
All those, you know, all those folks that were saying that chemtrails didn't exist, that those were contrails or vapor or whatever, you know, well, those people probably work for the government.
Yeah. It gave them a way to create places where pseudo-facts and facts and dots could be connected to sell that set of ideas that looked like, oh, this looks like evidence, this looks legit, this looks as real as anything else I see on the internet, and gives them a way also to recruit others into their beliefs. What was before a kind of hard, difficult work on the fringes to print pamphlets and get them out, how do you do that? And therefore, the fringes tended to remain on the fringes. The internet allows the fringes to be mainstreamed over and over and over again. And that's what we've seen in the last 25 years. And so many of those fringe ideas about the malign intentions of the UN to send invading forces into Indiana became relatively and then absolutely mainstream ideas, especially on the right.
You've been paying attention to Donald Trump for a long time now. You co-founded Spy Magazine in 1986 and devoted a lot of pages and a few covers to him. Now, here we are in 2017, and Trump is president. He's probably the perfect spokesmodel for the fantasy industrial complex, isn't he?
Yes, he is, absolutely. And I'm very grateful that I started writing this a couple years before he was running for president, and then I finished it before he was elected president, because it has a cleaner, purer existence. I didn't take Donald Trump and say, oh, let me now reverse engineer how this came to be. It was the opposite. I wrote this, I thought about this for a decade, wrote it over a couple of years, and then he appeared and was elected president. Yes.
Yeah.
Spokesmodel, apotheosis, avatar, choose your word.
Yeah.
There he is.
Believe me, folks. Believe me.
I mean, almost every one of my threads is embodied by him. He is not very religious, as we know, and religion is one of my threads. However, he is overwhelmingly supported by tens of millions of the most extremely religious Americans there are. So, no, it was extraordinary. And I also just realized since the book came out that if I hadn't written it when I did, and if it hadn't come out now, and Donald Trump had come along before I wrote the book, I would have said, I should have written the book, but now I can't write it. It just looks like some fake explaining Donald Trump thing.
Yeah, impeccable timing on your part, for sure. I think it would be fair to say that one of the founding fathers of Fantasyland is Walt Disney. And the title of your book comes from one of the lands in his theme parks. What did Disney contribute to the fantasy industrial complex?
Well, first of all, I think Walt Disney was hugely important. And second of all, much, if not most of what he did in and of itself wasn't so terrible. It's just, but it does connect to what I'm talking about. And I think I'm not even talking about his amazing achievement as a animated film creator and producer. I'm really talking about Disneyland and especially not so much Fantasyland, but the more real things, like, for instance, Main Street USA, which was this recreation of and a kind of evocation of the small town of Missouri where he'd grown up. And I think it was this astonishing, incredibly, profoundly influential model for how America and how American developers and restaurateurs and everybody decided, oh, I get it. This is sweet. We shouldn't tear down these old, well, maybe we should tear them down, but we can build fake ones that are just as good or better. And I think it became the model for housing, for real estate development, for renovating downtowns, and just in general, the kind of exquisite falsehood of Disneyland in general, beyond even Main Street USA, was a revelation, I think, that Americans just went head over heels for and said, oh, no, this is how I want to live. I want to live in my gated community, my themed gated community, or I want to eat at my themed restaurant, and so on and so forth. So that's the basic, my basic take on the incredible influence of Walt Disney in this. And then, of course, when his this visionary idea of Epcot before he died and was unable to do what he wanted was truly a visionary, fantastical remaking of urban America that he wanted to do, and not just a theme park. I mean, he really, I think he, in a certain sense, would be happy about what's happened in the half century since he died, because, you know, what started in Disneyland certainly did not stay in Disneyland.
Disney presents
The Wonderful World of Color.
Kurt Anderson is the author of Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire. From Fantasyland to Fantasies of Returning to Your Home Planet.
Am I homesick for another world? Yeah, I think we all are.
The award-winning writer Otessa Moshfegh joins us in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. If you can relate to characters with existential insecurities, and these days I think we all can, Otessa Moshfegh's fiction will resonate with you. She's a novelist and short story writer from Boston. Her mother's from Croatia, and her father is from Iran. Otessa has already put together a very impressive resume. Her first novel, Eileen, was shortlisted for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Man Booker Prize. The book won the Penn Hemingway Award for debut fiction. She recently released her first short story collection. It's called Homesick for Another World, which raises the question, is Otessa homesick for another world?
Coming out of the gate. Well, am I homesick for another world? Yeah, I think we all are in multiple ways. The title comes from the last story in the collection, a story called A Better Place. And I took the title from that story because that story feels the most personal to me, actually.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't any satire in it in the way that I use satire, I think, in most of the other stories in the collection. And it's written in a different register, and it is dealing with a kind of spiritual quandary or perhaps a misinterpretation of what life and death are in a way that I think all of the characters in the book experience, but this character from the story A Better Place in particular felt the most like me in her attitudes. So it felt natural to pick the title from that story, and that she is homesick for another world kind of described the general attitude I had toward this book, what I wanted this collection to be about.
And now would be the perfect time, actually, to have you read an excerpt from A Better Place. How about starting at the beginning?
Sure. A Better Place. I come from some other place, It's not like a real place on Earth or something I could point to on a map. If I even had a map of this other place, which I don't. There's no map because the place isn't a place like something to be near or in or at. It's not somewhere or anywhere, but it's not nowhere either. There is no where about it. I don't know what it is. But it certainly isn't this place, here on Earth, with all you silly people. I wish I knew what it was, not because I think it would be great to tell you about it. I just miss it so much. If I knew what it was, maybe I could make something like it here on Earth. Valdemar says it's impossible. The only way to get there is to go. Valdemar, I say to my brother, how do we get back to the place, to the thing, whatever? Oh, you have to die, or you have to kill the right person. That's his answer now. For a long time, he thought only the first part was true, but over time he's thought long and hard and figured out that there is a second way. The second way is much harder. I don't know how he figured it out, but thank God for Valdemar, who is so much wiser than me, though only a day older. I took some extra time to come out of the woman. I had doubts, even so early on, about this place here on Earth with all the dumb things everywhere. It was Valdemar who persuaded me to come out finally. I could hear his cries and feel his little fists poking through the woman's skin. He is my best friend. Everything he does, it seems, he does because he loves me. He is the best brother ever of all brothers here on Earth. I love him so much.
I can really relate to these feelings of being out of touch with the world and feeling like an outsider because I'm from Canada, first stop on this planet anyway. And even when I was still living there, I had this feeling, this sense of I don't belong here, which I guess is why one of my favorite songs is a song by Ben Vaughan called Too Sensitive for This World. In fact, I think you could go so far as to call it my theme song. Do you know this song?
I don't think I've ever heard it.
Let's roll the first minute of it and then we'll fade it out and I'll come in and see what you thought of it.
Great.
Okay.
Every day starts with a broken heart. I must be too sensitive for this world. Well, I know it ain't right. To cry every night, I must be too sensitive for this world. And the world is such a callous place. It's a wonder, it's a wonder.
What do you think of that? Do those lyrics resonate with you at all?
Oh, God, that's so heartbreaking, Doug.
It is, I know. I know, that's why it's my theme song.
Oh, well, I'm so glad that you work on the radio and you get to connect with the world in this way.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That you're so lucky.
Yes, I am, that's true.
You know, it makes me feel lucky that I get to connect with the world through my writing, too.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful song. It just makes me feel like, why don't we all just stop and appreciate each other more? You know,
yeah.
like, hey, do you see me? You know,
yeah.
That kind of feeling. It's so easy to just lose track of that and go about your day and just get stuck in your own head. And then at the end of the day, yeah, you feel completely isolated and alone. Or I should say, I can when I do that, when I don't make the effort to really look at people and connect.
Yeah. Your characters are so fascinating. They have these existential insecurities that I can really relate to. Yet at the same time, they're trying to, despite these insecurities, trying to connect with other people and to better themselves. And I couldn't help but notice that the first story is called Bettering Myself and the last story is called A Better Place. So if you don't mind my asking, how much of your characters' existential insecurities come from your own life?
All of them. Yeah. 110%.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't have the answers.
No.
I mean, in some ways, I'm asking these questions of my characters. Is this going to be the story where at the end I feel like I've figured out my own existence? Inevitably, no.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I've gotten a little closer to what my life is supposed to be, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read this story in The Atlantic in which you talk mm-hmm. about this video performed by a singer named, I'm going to butcher her pronunciation, Lena Zavaroni.
Oh, Lena Zavaroni.
Lena Zavaroni and her cover version of a Neil Sedaka song called Going mm-hmm. Nowhere. And it was very mm-hmm. interesting. I watched the video and just the response you had and the things you said about it were very, very intriguing and provocative. Can you tell me a bit about this video and why it means so much to you?
Well, I was so moved by the performance because the singer, Lena Zavaroni, is this really small, delicate creature that possesses this insanely powerful voice. And in this performance of Going Nowhere, it seems that she is being possessed by a spirit. And I really related to her and just respected and admired her so much for this vulnerability and strength and deep, unheard of wisdom in the way that she transforms this song. And then to find out a little bit more about her life made me just fall in love with her, and my heart broke for her, and she had a hard time of life.
A difficult relationship with her mother, right?
Yeah, and it sounds like a difficult relationship with the world, being someone with so much talent and so much artistry. You know, maybe she was too sensitive for this world, like your song.
And yeah.
She was successful and was getting attention from a young age. And to grow up in a world where you're being treated as a commodity and you're actually an artist, you know?
Yeah.
And that must have been really hard.
There was a really interesting part in this story where you said that writing saved your life.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a bit about that, about how writing saved your life?
Well, I think it saved my life in the way that it protected me from self-desertion at a young age. But it also, I think, protected who I was in that I could have an identity that was singular. I could have a relationship with myself through my creativity, and it had nothing to do with what anybody else was telling me.
Yeah.
And the messages I was getting from the world were mostly negative, or I was interpreting them as negative. So I could build an Otessa land, you know, out of my imagination, and in that be productive and feel like my life is good for something.
Otessa Moshbeg is the author of the short story collection, Homesick for Another World.
Now we have a hard-to-believe but true story out of Florida.
A Florida man says he shares his home with 2,000 Barbies.
Fantastic!
Florida airborne captain whose hand was bitten off by a 9-foot alligator now facing charges of feeding the animal.
What a divine place to live. Why anyone would want to live or go anywhere else is beyond me.
So why does so much weird news come out of Florida? Craig Pittman is the guy to ask. He's lived in Florida his whole life. And he's an award-winning reporter and columnist for Florida's largest newspaper, the Tampa Bay Times. Not only that, he's the author of a new book called Oh Florida: How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. I wanted to find out what Craig thought of Jon Stewart's description of the Sunshine State.
You live in a giant cockroach-choking, hazard-infested, Hooters-dining, reptile-abusing, Everglades-draining, election-ruining, stripper-motorboating, 24-hour mugshot factory.
What do you think of that, Craig?
It's true as far as it goes, but it's not the whole story. And that's sort of my argument in my book, is that
yes, Florida is the punchline state. Yes, all this wild, weird, comical stuff happens here, and that's what makes it interesting to live here. But on the other hand, there's also a lot of stuff happening that influences people all around the world, and they don't even realize it.
Like what?
Well, for instance, the guy who invented the computer, John Adanasoff, he grew up here. His dad worked at a phosphate mine, the place that has, you know, sinkholes and serious other problems, and always wore a slide rule, you know, to do his calculations. And young John became fascinated with his dad's slide rule, and that set him on his course to eventually inventing that thing that we use to play online solitaire and look at cat videos.
You've lived in Florida all your life, right?
So far.
Yeah, yes. So far, yes. There's still time to get out. Do you have a personal story that you can share that would give us a sense of what life in Florida is like?
The one I mentioned in the book is to sort of give you a sense of what it's like here. Is I was camping with the Boy Scouts when I was a kid, and I was trying to cross this river, and I fell in. And I didn't know how to swim at the time, and the river kind of started sweeping me away. And at the last minute, I'm looking up. I can look through this wonderfully clear water and see this beautiful sky and everything above me. And at the last minute, I happened to see this rope stretched across the swimming area, and I grabbed it, and that got me out. And so to me, that kind of sums up Florida. We're surrounded by dangerous beauty, in way over our heads, pulled along by powerful forces, and desperately grabbing for any lifeline.
Very well said, yeah. So I want to talk to you about that, the powerful forces that surround Florida. Living under this constant threat of natural disasters, doesn't this take a huge psychic toll on you and your fellow Floridians?
Sure. That's sort of the thing is, you know, it gives you this sense that everything you build can be washed away at any minute. And so, you know, hey, let's live for today. And a lot of people really take that to heart. They do things and don't worry about the consequences because eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may be wiped out by a sinkhole or a shark bite or lightning, all of which happen more in Florida than any other state. So it leads to this sort of YOLO culture in Florida.
Yeah, you only live once.
And that's honestly part of what makes it kind of fun to be a journalist here is writing about all the people who grab for the gusto and miss.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see what the consequences are, because there are consequences when you do crazy things. One recent example, there was a guy in, I think it was Lehigh Acres, who drove up to the edge of a canal, a 20-foot wide canal, and got out and looked across to see how wide it was, and then got back in the car and backed way up and revved his Toyota Corolla and took off. And, of course, he did not complete the Evel Knievel jump across the canal.
Did he hurt himself?
No, but the car was completely submerged. And by the way, there was a bridge two blocks away.
Oh. Interesting. We're kind of having a very loose theme in this episode, a unified theory theme.
I love a unified theory.
Oh, yeah. I know you do. Naturally, being the intrepid journalist that I am, I have to ask you about your unified theory of Florida, in which you address the question that looms so large in the minds of your fellow Americans in the other 49 states, and probably in Florida, too, which is, why does Florida produce so much weird news? You've come up with a very detailed and very nuanced unified theory to explain this. Let's unpack your theory a bit.
Okay.
Starting with the weather. What part does the weather play in Florida's production of weird news?
Well, we don't have any snow, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, people are able to be out doing weird stuff all year long. They're not cooped up inside by yeah. blizzards the way they are in, you know, Ohio and Wyoming and places like that. And in fact, the good weather also encourages lots of nudist resorts to open here.
Mm-hmm.
So those things happen in the nudist resorts that end up in the news. And of course, the way news people are anything involving nudity is automatically funny.
Yeah. Why is that?
We're all Beavis and Butthead. What can I tell you? So a shark attack at the nude beach in Miami. Oh, haha, they had a shark attack.
Yeah.
At a nude beach, and the nudists are still going there. My favorite one is the one that happened recently where somebody asked me this question. I said, I don't know. So I called up one of our local nudist resorts and said, are you guys providing shelter for hurricane evacuees? And they said, yes, absolutely. We have our own generators. We have a hotel here. We're inviting people to come in. And I said, will you be changing your rules? And they said, no, we are still clothing optional. So, so I was able to write a story saying you can evacuate there and you don't have to take your clothes, so you don't have to pack as much.
Yeah. What about people? This might be the most important part of your unified theory. The people who live in Florida, how do they influence the production of the state's weird news?
You look at the people who have moved here and the people who are making a living here, and we've got, you know, the first Hooters was started here in Florida. So we've got, you know, Hooters wait staff.
Mm-hmm.
We've got CIA agents who came down here to train for the Bay of Pigs and fell in love with the place. And so when they retired, they came back here and started a community and took over the local newspaper, and one of them actually wound up being elected to Congress, Porter Goss. We've got spam kings living here. We've got professional python hunters. We've got monkey breeders. We've got lots of retired circus people. Many of them live in the town of Gibsonton, which was the setting for my favorite X-Files episode, Humbug. And so, you know, you've got this really odd, interesting mix of people, and it naturally produces a lot of really interesting news. We had a story break just last year where the State Wildlife Commission had set up this very elaborate sting. They created their own alligator breeding farm in order to catch people in the business of poaching alligator eggs. And one of the people they arrested in this two-year thing was a former head of the Wildlife Commission from another state who had retired here.
Uh-oh.
And they caught the guy poaching alligator eggs.
Wow.
Got him on tape.
Yeah. As you write in your book, there's this misconception that Florida is a melting pot. You have this great quote from this Miami documentary filmmaker.
Yes, Billy Corbin.
Yeah.
Who does all these great 30 by 30 documentaries like Broke, where he said, yeah, we're not a melting pot. We're more like one of those TV dinners where everything kind of slops around a little bit.
Yeah. Sometimes the peas spill over into the mashed potatoes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's making that point because particularly in South Florida, you see tremendous poverty right next door to areas of tremendous wealth.
Mm-hmm. Also, the wild assortment of wildlife.
Yes.
Is a big part of so much of the weird news, isn't it?
Yes. We have more invasive species than any other state. So we've got the pythons that are very famous down in the Everglades. And I've been lucky to write several stories about pythons battling alligators for supremacy down there.
Do you have a favorite python versus alligator story?
Oh, probably the most famous one, where there's a biologist named Skip Snow who was in a helicopter and happened to spot down below this stark image and directed the copter pilot to land, and he took a picture, and the picture went absolutely viral of a python that had swallowed an alligator, but apparently the alligator had been clawing as it went down and made the python burst. So they both died in this sort of death struggle.
Craig Pittman is the author of O Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country.
You can recognize it as Rock Around the Clock, but it sounds like it's been filtered through time and distance.
The strange history of songs recorded on X-ray discs and the rebirth of black horror movies.
Get Out in some ways picks up where George Romero left off.
That's just ahead. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. How do you listen to your music these days? Digitally? On your computer? Maybe you've joined the analog renaissance and are listening to a lot of your favorite artists on vinyl. Whatever your preferred medium is, I bet you've never listened to music on X-ray film. But that's how some people in the Soviet Union listened to forbidden music back in the 1950s. Stephen Coates is the editor of a book called X-Ray Audio, The Strange Story of Soviet Music on the Bone.
I came across the phenomenon of bone music about 5 years ago. I was in St. Petersburg performing with my band, The Real Tuesday Weld. We'd done a show, and the next day we went to the flea market, just tourist shopping, as you do. And I came across a store with lots of strange objects on it. But one object in particular caught my attention because it looked a little bit like a record. And I asked my friends about it, my young Russian friends. They didn't know anything about it at all. And the guy whose stall it was not really interested in it. He sort of brushed it away. But I bought it and I brought it back to London. And I tried to play it. And the first thing I found out, it was 78 RPM. It was single-sided, very thin. But the strangest thing about it, of course, was that it was an X-ray. And the music on it was Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley. The music on this record, on the Bill Haley record, sounds pretty fuzzy. You can recognize it as Rock Around the Clock, but it sounds like it's been filtered through time and distance. It's pretty scratchy. It's obviously been well played. The image on the Bill Haley Rock Around the Clock record is iconic. It's a pair of hands which have been X-rayed. and it's got this slight flavour of a DJ about it with his hands on the record scratching or something. So it's become the symbol of this project for us. On X-ray discs, the most common image you will see is the rib cage, the sternum. And in fact, in Russia, older people who knew about these records often called it music on the bones, but often music on the ribs. That's because very commonly you had these pictures of people's chests and rib cage. And the reason is that in the 40s and 50s, probably later, everybody in the Soviet Union had to go and have their chest scanned to see if they had tuberculosis. So these records, in a way, say something about the health of the people of the time, too. Well, it's 100 years this year since the Russian Revolution. Russia became the Soviet Union. And in fact, in the 20s, it was a very exciting time culturally there, exciting musically, all sorts of electronic innovators and experimenters. We know about the theremin and all sorts of other things going on. Really exciting times, much more innovative and experimental than in the West, actually. But as the 20s wore on and into the 30s, a different kind of culture started to emerge, a political, ideological culture. And really, from the 30s onwards particularly, the idea of socialist realism started to be enforced, which is that all culture, all arts, had to meet the requirements and serve the purposes of the communist vision of the future. And what did that mean? Well, really, it seems to mean, in some ways, that what the leaders of the Communist Party, Stalin and his cohorts, liked. I mean, that's the only thing I can see. And they didn't like jazz, we know that. You know, dictators never like jazz, do they? And then, of course, the Second World War ended, the Cold War began. And so anything that was Western became forbidden. Of course, that meant jazz and later boogie-woogie, rock and roll, all that stuff. Well, we can understand that it's the politics of the Cold War. After all, we didn't hear much Russian music at that time ourselves. But the other story of these X-ray records, which is really important and often not talked about, is that the most of the music on them is Russian music. And it's Russian forbidden music. Music that was forbidden for a variety of reasons. For instance, music by people like Pyotr Leshenko, who was a Russian tango singer, hugely popular before the war. But he lived in the West. He was regarded as a white Russian, an emigre, a traitor, if you like, that he lived outside the Soviet Union and was seen as decadent and somewhat bourgeois. And so his repertoire became forbidden, even if he was singing about wine and roses, even if he was singing about the nobility of the working classes. It didn't matter what he was singing about because he himself became forbidden. Community of, let's call them audiophiles or music lovers, discovered a way to cut their own records, not by pressing them as we do in pressing plants, how vinyl is pressed in a plant, but writing them one by one using special machines called recording lathes. Now, somebody got hold of one of these machines in the Soviet Union, and then other people started to copy it, and they could use that to record. But what they're going to record onto? They haven't got access to the commercially available blanks that you'd use in the West. Well, at some point, somebody had the ingenious idea to used X-ray film. We don't really know who invented this technique, maybe one of those things that sort of simultaneously arose in various places, but they used it with a vengeance in Leningrad because, of course, it was easy for them to get hold of used X-rays from hospitals. The government had said all hospitals had to get rid of their X-rays after 1 year because at that time they were flammable, they were a fire risk. So the people who work in the hospital have got this job of getting rid of all this slippery, flexible stuff. And these guys will turn up at the back of the hospital in the evening with a few rubles and a bottle of vodka, and they'll take it off their hands. And they used it as a blank recording medium. Whenever this began, in the 40s, maybe even earlier, it was probably a small community of music lovers who were recording music onto X-Ray, forbidden music onto X-Ray, music that they loved, and passing it around between them. So a kind of personal, friendly trade. As the demand grew and more people started to do it, and as more people wanted to buy these records, well, then it became a street trade. And I suppose the best way to describe it would be like the soft drugs trade, say dealing in cannabis. You know, that trade would go on. Again, if you know somebody, you could go and see them or sort it out that way. Or if you didn't, you know, there's a maybe the odd place you can go to, a street corner or a square somewhere, and you could turn up if you're a young dude searching out some rock and roll, and there's a sort of shady guy standing there in the corner, and you go up to him and, you know, a few muttered words, rock and roll, tango, jazz, you know, and he'd open his coat in traditional way, and it was said that you could get about 25 of these records, which are flexible, under each side of your shirt, next to your ribs, which may be another reason that they call them ribs. And he would pull one out and sell it to you for a few rubles. X-Ray records were made at a time when music mattered so much that some people were prepared to go to prison for it. We don't live in such times, but I ask myself, as a musician, as a music lover, how much does music matter now? What would I risk if somebody took it all away from me? You know, what would I lose? What would I give up to get it back? Can music still cause a revolution in my soul, you know, in my bone? This is the thing which I ask myself, and it's the bigger story for me in these records. We live in a time when we've got infinite access to music, and that's amazing, I love it. But have we lost something at the same time?
Ezekiel connected them, tribones, Ezekiel connected them, tribones, now hear the word of the Lord.
Stephen Coates is the editor of X-Ray Audio, The Strange Story of Soviet Music on the Bone. You can find a link to Stephen's documentary on our website, wpr.org/beta. From music on the bone to bone-chilling horror, we move to black horror films. One of the best films of this past year was Get Out, directed by Jordan Peele. Peele created a scary movie that tackles racism in a very provocative way. Get Out marks a watershed moment in the history of black horror movies, especially compared to the 1915 film The Birth of a Nation, directed by D.W. Griffith. The Birth of a Nation was not a black horror film, but it was definitely horrific in the way it portrayed African Americans. Robin Means Coleman is a professor at the University of Michigan, and she's the author of Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Films from the 1890s to Present.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
A real turning point in the way African Americans were portrayed in horror films occurred in 1968 with the release of George A. Romero's genre-defining zombie movie, Night of the Living Dead. What was so groundbreaking about Night of the Living Dead?
Night of the Living Dead, one of my favorite movies, is incredible on two fronts. The first is that Romero introduces this character, a black character named Ben. Up until this point, there had been a history in horror films where blacks were really mistreated. The blacks in horror films followed the kind of D.W. Griffith stereotyping where they were depicted as deficient and deviant. Romero doesn't do that. In fact, Ben is... he is smart, he's resourceful, he is in some ways quite the intellectual, and what we see is Ben trapped in this remote cabin, surrounded by the undead who are really trying to get them and eat them, and Ben is navigating both the horrors on the outside of this cabin, but also what is sort of horrific on the inside of the cabin, which is negotiating complex race and gender relationships.
We gotta fix these boards. You're crazy. Those things are going to be in every window and door in this place. We've got to get down into the cellar.
Go down in that damn cellar. Get out of here!
I'm taking the girl with me.
You leave her here.
Keep your hands off here. And everything else that's up here, too. Because if I stay up here, I'm fighting for everything up here. And the radio and the food is part of what I'm fighting for. Now, if you're going down the cellar, get...
Yeah, and we should point out that unlike in The Birth of a Nation, Ben is played by a black actor, a gentleman by the name of Dwayne Jones. So the ending of Night of the Living Dead is very powerful. Can you talk a bit about that?
Ben emerges. He survives the night, and he's the sole survivor of this horrific kind of zombie holocaust. And he survives all of the turmoil that's happening inside the cabin. And he emerges, and the sun is rising, and he's victorious. And then he's killed. He's not killed by zombies. He's killed by the police. He's killed by sheriffs, and in the case of Night of the Living Dead, these were real officers who were cast in the film.
Let's go check out the house. There's something there. I heard a noise. All right, Vince, hit him in the head, right between the eyes. Good shot. Okay, he's dead. Let's go get him. That's another one for the fire.
So he's killed by Pennsylvania state troopers who then do something far worse, if you can imagine that, which is to essentially burn him on a pyre. And we've seen the kinds of horrific images of slaves being burned and burned alive. And so it evokes all of those memories. And it was just such a blow. And yeah. It was real.
Yeah. And the officers in the narrative of the film, we're led to believe that the police officers who shot Ben mistook him for a zombie. Or are we?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about the openness of the text.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps, you know, and I think Romero leaves that sufficiently open that perhaps they think that he's a zombie. And at the same time, perhaps in the back of our minds, we're supposed to think that, well, police officers are fairly used to shooting first and figuring out what's happening later, and especially black men.
Yeah, and that's especially relevant these
Today.
Days, unfortunately. Yeah, yeah. During the credits, we see this series of still images of the handling of Ben's body, that they use hooks to take him over to a fire and burn him. You say that those look like, that the still images over the credits look like they could be the weathered photos of Emmett Till.
Lynching imagery for sure.
Let's fast forward to February 2017 and the release of Jordan Peele's Get Out. Can you give us a brief outline of the film's plot without, of course, revealing too many spoilers?
So Get Out focuses on a black male character, Chris Washington, and his girlfriend, who is white, Rose Armitage. They're taking a road trip from Brooklyn, an urban space, a very diverse space, and they're going to visit Rose's family, the Armitages, who are in a really quite white suburban space. And so this is going to be a movie about how Chris navigates this predominantly white space.
By the way, I would have voted for Obama for a third term if I could. Best president in my lifetime, hands down.
I agree, yeah.
At least that's what we think it's going to be about. Because when Chris arrives, he realizes that this is a family who is deeply involved in medicine. And ultimately, he comes to realize that they're involved in medical experimentation. And so Chris is now fighting for his life in this movie.
Do you have a favorite scene in the film?
I do, and it's a subtle scene, and it's not one that folks will point to. I think many audiences will point to the ending and Chris's relationship with his best friend, Rod, who is a TSA agent. But there's another scene performed by actress Betty Gabriel. She portrays Georgina. And what we know about Georgina is that she's the maid in this home. She's the black maid in this home. But if you know the plot line of Get Out, she's also something else. And so her blackness and this something else that is monstrous is trapped in a single body. And so Georgina is physically showing this battle, this internal battle that is happening. And so she is able to laugh and cry real tears at the same time.
If there's too many white people, I get nervous, you know.
Oh, no.
do something. That's not my experience. Not at all. The Armitages are so good to us. They treat us like family.
It is a heart-wrenching scene, and you know just how terrible, how awful these experiments are for Black bodies.
How do you think white audiences experience Get Out versus how Black audiences experienced it? I'm guessing they had to have experienced it differently.
White and Black audiences alike, I think, really liked this film, if box office numbers are any indication. But the other thing that Get Out does is that it, in some ways, picks up where George Romero left off and demands that we all pay attention to our social, our political, our cultural context. And so Get Out demands that we pay attention to race relationships. It demands that we pay attention to issues such as redlining and white flight and the creation of so-called white topias, to use Rich Benjamin's language. So it's asking us to say, how far have we really come in understanding the commonalities and also the unique cultural difference between Blacks and whites?
And that's it for this edition of Beta. Special thanks to our technical director and music director, Steve Gotcher, and WPR Next executive producer, Adam Friedrich. Thanks to Joe Hartke for his engineering help. And of course, a big thanks to you for listening. Let us know what you think and listen again at wpr.org/beta. Until next time, I'm Doug Gordon.